I'm Michael Roberts. I'm the executive director here at the Fine Arts Work Center, and delighted to welcome you to what I think is our first big public event of the new fellowship season, which just began on October 1st. So we have a new crop of wonderful fellows, and they are many among you in the audience are in that lucky group. So say hi to them, and they will say hi to you. I think you all know that those men and women, visionary people, I always say, whose photographs are over in the front hallway, and I urge you to go by and see them if you haven't seen them recently, who invented the idea of the Fine Arts Work Center, and they have made it a very important stop in the international circuit for the arts and letters for almost 50 years now. And we were immensely fortunate, as you all also know, to have really a kind of elder statesman of American poetry, Stanley Kunitz, among us for many years, and also the Pulitzer Prize winner, Alan Dugan, on our writing committee for many years, and a number of other distinguished poets who drew their fellows from the craft of poetry from all over the country and indeed the world, including three Nobel laureates, one of whom we're here to celebrate tonight. These luminous guests provided mentorship and support to generations of Work Center fellows while also relishing the unique beauty of the Outer Cape and what we all love so much about this place. One of the greatest, I think, of these visitors was Seamus Heaney, who was here on a number of occasions during the 1980s and 90s after he met our own Romolo Del Deo, who was an undergraduate at Adams House. I think I have the sequence right. And so, in addition to being perhaps the greatest living poet writing in English, Seamus Heaney was an important influence on a number of our fellows over the years, including Tom Slay and Lucy Brock Broido and many others whom you've heard of and a lot of more that you may not yet have heard of. He also believed in and exemplified a tradition that has been a part of the Work Center's fellowship from the beginning, and that is great masters of the arts providing mentorship to a rising generation of artists and writers. So it's fitting that we have another esteemed contemporary writer, Sven Birkerts, with us tonight to meet the fellows and to speak about the Seamus Heaney that he knew and whom we remember and revere. One of the things that Heaney liked best about the Work Center was the mutually enriching coexistence of the literary and visual arts. He used to talk about the conjunction of these arts in the Yeats family, where the great poet's father and brother both made names for themselves as visual artists, and this was a dialogue that was, I think, important to Heaney. And so when I learned that one of our surviving founders, Salvatore Del Deo, had met Seamus Heaney through his son and had gone to Adams House to create a life portrait of this great poet in the form of a copper plate etching, I thought, what better way to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Seamus Heaney's well-deserved Nobel Prize, which I think was 1995, and also what Tom Slay, and I think everyone who met and knew Seamus Heaney would agree that he was the person with, and these are Tom Slay's words, the greatest gift for friendship of anyone I've ever known. And so I think we're also celebrating tonight the genius of this place, where every year writers and artists forge friendships and creative linkages that often last through their lives. And so to remember Seamus and to mark this anniversary, Sal has worked with our printroom manager, Vicky Tomeko, to create four new prints from the original copper etching, and you see the beautiful result tonight. So let me just tell you a little about Sal. He grew up in Providence, attended the Rhode Island School of Design, the Vesper George School of Art in Boston, and the Art Students League in New York, where he studied with Edwin Dickinson and John McPherson. As a young painter, he began attending Henry Henschy's summer classes here in Provincetown and set up his easel on the bay. In 1954, he settled permanently in Provincetown, and he's exhibited in New York at Helio Galleries and in Providence, Cambridge, and Boston. His paintings are in the National Portrait Gallery of the Smithsonian in Washington. They're at Harvard University and our own Art Association Museum, the Williams College Museum of Art, among others. Together with his wife, the historian and author Josephine Del Deo, he was one of the founders of the Fine Arts Work Center. So let's just give a hand to Sal for this lovely etching. So the order tonight is that we're going to have a couple of poems, as inevitably we have to have some of Seamus's poetry. And I should say that despite extensive demands, I am not going to read any of the poetry that I composed in the class that I was privileged to take with Seamus Heaney many years ago. That'll be for the after party. Let's see. We first have Sophia Sinclair, who's one of our poets, and she will read The Grauballe Man from Seamus Heaney.
Thank you. So I'm reading The Grauballe Man, which Heaney wrote about the sacrificed bodies that were pulled from the bog in Denmark that were like perfectly preserved from the 5th century BC. The Grauballe Man. As if he had been poured in tar, he lies on a pillow of turf and seems to weep the black river of himself. The grain of his wrists is like bog oak, the ball of his heel like a basalt egg. His instep has shrunk cold as a swan's foot or a wet swamp root. His hips are the ridge and purse of a muscle, his spine an eel arrested under a glisten of mud. The head lifts, the chin is a visor raised above the vent of his slashed throat that has tanned and toughened. The cured wound opens inwards to a dark elderberry place. Who will say corpse to his vivid cast? Who will say body to this opaque repose, and his rusted hair a mat unlikely as a fetus's? I first saw his twisted face in a photograph, a head and shoulder out of the peat, bruised like a forceps baby. But now he lies perfected in my memory, down to the red horn of his nails, hung in the scales with beauty and atrocity, with the dying gall too strictly compassed on his shield, with the actual weight of each hooded victim, slashed and dumped. Thanks.
Thank you, Sophia. Another wonderful thing about Seamus Heaney was his embrace of world poetry and untiring efforts to, in essays and travels all around the world, to promote literary exchange. He was really a kind of world statesman of poetry. So it seems appropriate that this event tonight should be sponsored by CEC ArtsLink, which is an international organization promoting artistic exchange between America and Eastern Europe, from which some marvelous poetry has come over the last 75 years or so. And we are this month hosting a CEC ArtsLink fellow, Gosia Rozanska-Branietzka, who's played a key role, and apologies for any mispronunciation of her beautiful Polish name. She's played a key role in organizing tonight's program, and she's going to read tonight Seamus Heaney's elegy for the great Polish poet Zbigniew Herbert.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you very much for coming, and I just wanted to use this opportunity to thank the Fine Arts Work Center for hosting me and for choosing me as their fellow within this fellowship. To the shade of Zbigniew Herbert. You were one of those from the back of the north wind whom Apollo favored and would keep going back to in the winter season. And among your people, you remained his herald whenever he departed, and the land was silent and summer's promise thwarted. You learned the lyre from him and kept it tuned. Thank you.
And finally, tonight, essayist and literary critic Sven Burkerts is the author of 9 books, including The Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in an Electronic Age, My Sky Blue Trades, Growing Up Counter in a Contrary Time, and most recently, Changing the Subject, Art and Attention in the Internet Age. He's received grants from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Foundation and the Guggenheim Foundation. He was the winner of the Citation for Excellence in Reviewing from the National Book Critics Circle in 1985 and the Spielvogel Diamondstein Award from Penn for the best book of essays published in 1990. Burkerts has reviewed regularly for the New York Times Book Review, The New Republic, Esquire, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He's taught writing at Harvard, Emerson, Amherst College, and Mount Holyoke College, and directs the graduate Bennington Writing Seminars in Bennington, Vermont. He lives in Arlington, Massachusetts, with his wife and 2 children. Please welcome Sven Burkerts.
Thank you. Good evening. This is, every now and then you get a truly wonderful sort of day, something to look forward to and then to have happen when it arrives. And this was one of those days, you know, on a whole number of fronts. Just to be able to have as the plan to drive down on a November afternoon from Boston to the Cape. We, as a family, came at least probably every summer for about 15 years, and so the Cape is a real familiar and dear place. I also, just knowing that we'd be talking about Seamus Heaney and knowing how much this place in particular was one of his locations, a place he loved for itself and through many of the people, some of whom have been mentioned, you know, Lucy Brock-Broido, Tom Slay, Michael Mazur, Gail Mazur, a lot of people, and so conversation was often sort of irrigated with talk of the Fine Arts Work Center, as it is anyway, all the time, everywhere, you know. I knew the challenge. I mean, mountains and mountains have been written about Seamus Heaney, and but I knew that this was a kind of occasion which was really centered around this visual item in a sense, and the point of that, I would think, would be to capture something of the spirit of the man. And I said, well, that's what I'd like to do anecdotally and from my own angle. Because he was so important to me as a figure, a friend, and in ways that will emerge, you know, I've taken many shots at writing about Seamus, wanting to somehow get at that spirit. It seems so generative, and if I ever feel I make contact with it, it's kind of a, you know, affirming feeling. So I'm going to read 2 very different excerpts from some of these attempts of mine to catch the man. They make up kind of a diptych, and the first one is far more anecdotally personal. The second is back a few steps, and it's taken from a different angle. So you might hear a little bit of a tonal shift when I move from one section to the other, but I think it's pretty self-explanatory. The first time I spoke with Seamus Heaney was at a poetry reading in Cambridge back in the early 1980s. he was not himself reading, was just in the audience, and I forget who the reader was. I only remember being in my seat and feeling the sweep of my gaze suddenly catch when I saw that the poet was seated just a few rows away. Seamus Heaney. There are moments when life goes into italics. I knew who he was. I had read some of his work. I had heard he had a visiting position at Harvard, but none of these things squared up with that indefinable distinctive presence that he seemed to have. I want to say he stood out, but did he? Did he possess a distinct actual presence that I registered, or was I just projecting upon him? Projection is such a powerful business. I've more than once found myself marveling at some individual's obvious distinction only to be corrected. No, not him, the man over there. Oh. In any case, there he was, a few seats over, and for the duration of the reading, I was more aware of his nearby presence than of the poet reading. Sorry. When the event was over, this I remember very clearly, there was a reception at the rear of the same room. I should say that back then, I professed myself a great believer in fates, coincidences, destinies, all of which designate slightly different things, but which stirred together here will represent my basic state of mind. I saw it as a stroke of something that I should be standing by the cheese and crackers at the same time as the Irish poet. And it was a purposeful movement of the stars that got us into conversation. I can't remember how it started, but there we were, holding our plastic cups, Seamus being interrupted every few moments by a fellow poet or student, me abiding patiently as if we were having a discussion that needed returning to. I don't think we were. More likely, I simply did not know how to nod and step away. And my guess, thinking back, is that Seamus recognized this awkward, adhering ineptitude and did nothing that would highlight it. We stood together companionably until I finally excused myself. I had stood with the great poet. We had talked of this and that. It had not been a complete embarrassment. End of story. But no, in fact, coincidence, fate, destiny, there's more. For after I left, I started for home vibrating with the thrill of that encounter. I just had to take a detour to the One Potato, Two Potato, the bar and restaurant down the street from the bookstore where I then worked. I sat down and ordered a beer. And who should walk in just a few minutes later but the poet, by himself. Of course, he spotted me sitting there, and in my hindsight analysis, he had several choices available, other than turning on his heel, that is. He could have nodded, smiled, and gone about his business, or he could have done what Seamus, in fact, did, a gesture which I now see is completely in character, make his way over and ask if I wanted company. I linger for so long in this first meeting because it was the basis of what came to be a vital friendship in my life, and because various key themes and traits of personality, his and mine, were to be discerned there. I also need to underscore my still unschooled zealousness, for that was an agent. It was the thing that propelled me into that original conversation at the reception, and also maybe persuaded the poet that here was an intense young man, handy with an opinion or a quip. How I must have scrambled to be worthy. Another element, though, was Seamus's surprising availability and his kind follow-through. That he would take a seat beside me and order a pint seemed unthinkable to me then. Could I have done so in his place? Not easily. I come from a more held-in and watchful cultural background. Seamus, for his part, was from a world of pints bought and toasts offered. Be that as it may, when he came over, I saw it as a far greater confirmation than it likely was. What did we talk about? I have no distinct memory. Whatever it was, from my side, I'm sure it was all about appearing worthy, being seen as a real reader and writer. Otherwise, how to place a claim on the man's attention? I was at that time beginning to write reviews. I had written an essay on Derek Walcott, a poet I knew Seamus much admired. Surely we talked about Walcott. Also, I must have asked him questions about himself, his work, asked for what he was like, his manner. I know I was struck then and again over the years by a particular gesture, which was more than a gesture. It was in fact part of his manner, his grain. This was Seamus's way of appearing to confide. I've observed it now in its many subtly shaded variations, his way of leaning in slightly before saying something, a check in the voice, a hesitation, as if he were questioning whether he could in fact reveal or admit something, and then deciding that yes, he could. A gesture of glancing to one side or the other to make sure he would not be overheard. These mannerisms were habitual to Seamus and very convincing to me, not just on that first night, but always. They made me feel singled out, deemed worthy, admitted to the circle of those in the know about these important matters. After the saying, often would come that hint, a momentary expression, that air of, maybe I shouldn't have spoken so freely. But this too, when brushed aside, felt like an intimacy. That's the word I want, intimacy. Seamus had a great ability to favor people with the sense of being intimates. He created the promise of bringing you in on things, making you privy. And though this would seem to have nothing to do with his poetry, there is a way in which it relates. For isn't it a feature of this poet's use of language that the reader feels brought closer to what feels like the secret of things? Not all poets manage this. Not all poets seek to. And invoking immediacy asks a very particular gift. Seamus had this art with his language and with his interactions with people as well. In closed settings with familiars and in larger public settings too. He made it work by transforming the settings, making them feel intimate. This he might do by telling sly anecdotes and invoking in his remarks various kindred spirits, poets, and friends, and also by the working of his voice, which was, how often this has been remarked, an extraordinary instrument, warm and assuring and always used with subtle inflection, often to lightly mock the ostensible gravitas of the situation. Seamus was funny. Alert to and thus inviting humor in others, he also tipped toward going for the laugh himself. He was a raconteur, fond of recasting the witty phrasings of friends and fellow poets, and fond, too, of elaborating the contexts that made this or that line a topper. His scene setting, and indeed much of his conversation, relied on facial expression, and his repertoire encompassed everything from pious sanctimoniousness and connivance to the thousand subtle gradations of self-inflation. The timing was impeccable. To begin with, primary to everything was the Seamus air, and to some degree assumed, but I also believe authentic and defining, of being an innocent, a country boy, a bit rough around the edges, never not, in Wordsworth's phrase, surprised by joy. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, yes, but for all that, it did not somehow seem a downward affectation that he would tuck his napkin into his collar like a bib when he ate. That was Seamus. It flashed his rural dairy origins to everyone present. And by the same token, he could announce some new honor or prize, an invitation from the Empress of Japan, and with such evident unmasked delight that all was forgiven from the threshold. Given how many honors came his way, it's amazing how little he came in for deprecatory asides behind his back, at least in my experience, and this might not have been true in Ireland. His joy was of such a nature that one felt compelled to share in his pleasure and not look to gainsay it. If Seamus enjoyed and could not help creating the chemistry of intimacy in his relations with people, so also did he take pleasure in passing back and forth over that boundary line between public and private, scripted and natural, pretentious and humble. God knows his circumstance set him up for it. He was the Boylston Professor of Rhetoric at Harvard. But visiting him in his rooms at Adams' house, you could not but notice that he had hand-washed his socks in the sink and draped them on the bathroom radiator. He loved the loosening of the tie, the putting up of the feet, the fishing around with a fork in the takeout container. He loved letting the whole charade of manners and pretenses drop. By which I mean he was not just happy to stop putting on expected manners, but he liked the action itself. That little drop kick administered to some bit of rigmarole at the same time as the cork was being pulled from the bottle. The fact of the former accentuated the pleasure of the latter, added to its savor. And the pulling of that cork, the unscrewing of that cap, was a distinct pleasure, ushering in conviviality, the promise of free talk and joking. It represented stepping off the clock, for Seamus in his working days was the most organized and punctual of individuals. And waving off the constraining idea of limit, he was a great one for one more. And it was not, I think, just that he enjoyed the drink itself, though surely he did, but also because to choose to have one more was to have no one prescribing what was enough. The gleam in his eye, the little conspiratorial smile, as he pretended to debate whether just a little splash more was not in order. Drink, shared drink, made the stories more elaborate, the digressions more outrageous and comical, the expressions bolder, the adopted accents that much more ridiculous. The aim for all of us was to reach some pitch of perfect celebratory frivolity and release. What is amazing in retrospect is how often it was reached. Through story and joke, but also through poetry and song. The evening was not complete, it seemed, until lines, many lines, had been spoken and some number of songs sung. Neither happened by design. It was just that one thing led to another. Poets will cite poetry. It's almost axiomatic. One cited line begetting another, the lines spoken out not as if for oral exam, though which of us did not wish for the accolade of Seamus's look of pleasure, but spoken because at a certain pitch of social lubrication, a better language was wanted, or else a song, an air. And here his wife Mari would happily oblige, as would my wife Lynn, or the two together, and Seamus would sit back and his eyes would close. That's the more personal part of the diptych, and then you'll see there is a slight tonal shift. I was in the last days of a family vacation in a house on a lake in northern Vermont when I got the news that Seamus Heaney had died. It was the 30th of August, not in the dead of winter, as when Yeats, his great predecessor, as greatest living Irish poet, had died, also at age 74. In his great poem on that loss, W.H. Auden had written, "Let the Irish vessel lie empty of its poetry, emptied of its poetry." Yeats died in January of 1939. Seamus was born in April of that year, and remarkably, the vessel was refilled. Now we await another elegist as great as Auden. I was vacationing away from cities and had not really expected to have an internet connection, had indeed been looking forward to not having it. But wires go everywhere these days, and the will to cut oneself off voluntarily is weak. I was the first one awake. It was early morning. The lake was still misted over. I had started the coffee and was taking a few minutes to catch up on screen business. There was something from my poet friend, Peter Balakian. I noticed the subject heading, Seamus Heaney at 74, but thought nothing of it. No, that's not quite true. I unthinkingly assumed that this was news of some commemoration, a birthday salute, though I knew, as we all did, that his birthday was in April, that he shared his date with Samuel Beckett. When I opened the email and saw that there was no message, just a link, I clicked, and then all at once I was awake and trying to take in what I was reading. Seamus Heaney was dead. Seamus was dead. I used the first name because we were friends, not best friends. He had his various true intimates, but real friends. That's what I tell myself. We had met at a poetry reading in Cambridge back in the early 1980s, soon after he started his once-a-year teaching job at Harvard. He was approachable, easy to have a drink with, and soon enough, a circle of friends had fastened around him. There were dinners, long evenings, at our house and at other houses. Seamus, his wife Mari, when she was over for a visit, poets of his acquaintance. It was all very gregarious. We were 30 years younger then. Later, after he had stopped teaching at Harvard, there were still visits in Cambridge, in Dublin, more long evenings, but also less contact. I knew Seamus had had a stroke a few years ago. I'd seen him several times since and had noted its effects. A presence massively solid had been shaken, but the spirit was mighty, and it was unthinkable that he would not go on and on. Seamus Heaney at 74. I had not seen my poet friend Peter, who'd sent the link, for some months, but I remember that the last time we'd spoken, it had been about Seamus. Last winter, I'd been invited to the college where he teaches to give a talk, which I did. The next morning, before I drove back to Boston, my friend and I had coffee, and we talked mainly about Seamus, our mutual friend. For it was Seamus who had decided decades ago, for whatever reason, that we ought to know one another. We talked much about his kindness and his canny intuitions. He was a person whom it feels good to talk about. But now it was the end of summer, and Peter was sending the impossible news, and my first reaction, alongside complete disbelief, was not the grave sense of the loss of my friend, but something else, a feeling that was strangely collective. Auden wrote of the moment of Yeats' death that, quote, he became his admirers, and I had the strongest feeling just then of what he meant. I conjured all at once, if this is possible, the idea, the emotional image of all those who knew and loved Seamus, or knew and loved his work, or both, and I felt inside the ghostly trace of a circuitry that in this one moment all over the world, and of course most densely in Ireland, in Dublin, and most overwhelmingly on his own home ground in Sandymount, this same shock of incomprehension, not yet bereavement, was being registered. I pictured one person after another, dozens perhaps, and these were only the people who I knew who had a connection. Of course, there were hundreds, many hundreds more. When I drove down to the general store later to get the New York Times and the Boston Globe, that sense was confirmed. There was massive front page coverage everywhere, the biggest I'd ever seen for the death of a writer. It's dangerous, I know, to have a person stand for something, be representative in the sense that the poet Ralph Waldo Emerson had, in 1850, that one individual could in any way embody the spirit of a historical period seems archaic, as does the notion that a period could have a spirit. Our cultural mantra is plurality, complex, polyvalence, and the intensifying deluge of information ensures more of the same. Character itself is a contested concept. Yet when Seamus died in August, in the days and weeks that followed, there was a sense throughout the literary world, but in the larger culture as well, that a singular and, I will risk the word, representative greatness had been taken from our midst. Many thousands of people were mourning, not just the loss of a buoyant personality and an artist of the rarest verbal gifts, but something more. Obituaries and reminiscences the world over testified to qualities Seamus was felt to stand for. Maybe this was a kind of wishful thinking, a matter of projection. Yet in another way, that's beside the point. Our wishes and projections are real and powerfully telling. They are us. Seamus Heaney was seen as the man of place, as a sensibility tuned at once to the immediacies of the world around him. His poetry bristles with thingness, the felt presence of the real, and to the intimations of spirit, the idea that experience is charged with a higher, if not readily nameable, significance. He was at the same time a poet of profound historical imagination, alert not only to the ongoing factional struggles of his native Ireland and their roots in complex, age-old divisions, but also to what might be called our tribal memory. Reading him, we feel the truth of the French philosopher Simone Weil's obvious but elusive assertion that time is real. It is, manifestly. Seamus wrote of bog people exhumed from the peat, but also of the ancient gods, their survival in epiphanic occasions of the spirit. He translated Sophocles and brought Beowulf into the context of the present, and he did so through a feat of prodigious linguistic resuscitation. Seamus fused in his work the power of unmediated attentiveness, of focus, and an ear attuned to the highly nuanced layerings of language. If he was an etymologist, it was never as a scholar looking for derivations, but as a poet looking to expose the living pulses of the past through words. In the early poem, Personal Helicon, which was written in 1966, Heaney describes himself as a child fascinated by the mysterious depths of wells. He writes, "I love the dark drop, the trapped sky, the smells of waterweed, fungus, and dank moss." And later, "Others had echoes, gave back your own call, with the clean new music in it." He concludes, "Now to pry into roots, to finger slime, to stare, big-eyed narcissus, into some spring is beneath all adult dignity. I rhyme to see myself, to set the darkness echoing." In Heaney, then, in the poetry and the image of the man are distilled certain essential qualities, understandings, ways of relating to the world that could be said to be under threat. His extraordinary physical immediacy comes through as unmediated, as opposed to the unquiet, fidgety, ever-impending now in which we live. His poems give us the felt, articulated sense of the past. Our sense of ambient ubiquity yields, in line after line, to evocations of place utterly granular, palpable, and syllable, and sound. But enough now of my attributions and projections. Surely the point has been made. It only remains to wonder how it was that the poet kept himself so focused, how he avoided being swept away by the essential, the indispensable gadgets. Did he really manage, living in the new millennium, to stay clear of the screens and circuits and the dissipating pull of it all? I don't want to sanctify the man. It cannot have been easy. I studied Seamus enough to know that he was a sly self-preservationist, wily in his pretenses of technological ineptitude. To put it about that he felt too old-fashioned for the internet, that was a ploy. The man knew damn well that if he ever made himself available in that realm, he would have no time to call his own. Wisely, discreetly, he employed a proxy, an assistant who filtered messages sent to her name and who responded on his behalf. What he did have, and used apparently with great deftness, was a cell phone. I was shocked to learn this. A friend of his, a fellow Irish poet, I can name him now, Paul Muldoon, confided to me that he and Seamus had great sport texting one another. Seamus? Texting? Indeed, the poet's last communication was a text, according to his son. From the hospital bed, intending them for his wife, he dictated two words in Latin, "Noli timere," be not afraid. It was an extraordinary and heartening consolation, but also very much a private one. If there was a glimmer of something for the rest of us, it was maybe that there in the way It was maybe there in the way the timeline was folded back on itself. Words from the old dead language flashing up on the screen not long before the end, or else the momentous transit. So that's what I have about Seamus. And a few thoughts. I should have checked the time, but I really did want to remark this thing that just has always bedeviled me, fascinated me, and I love the mystery of it. And it's the fact that there are two utterly, in a sense, opposing kinds of energy. He had two, at least he had probably many, but two utterly singular attributes, and I would say, you know, had them to the level of a kind of genius. One, which I think everyone knows or agrees with, is, you know, the genius of poetry. Not just the words on the page, but what it took from a person and to get those words onto the page. And he was a poet who wrote a great deal, and a great deal of it is lasting and profound. And those things don't come from the lighter layers of the psyche. They come from deep drilling. So there's that energy, which, you know, is the core energy of the art, and that is centripetal. It seeks the center. It's inward going. But his second genius is enormous thing, which I just find truly remarkable. It's not just that he was a friendly guy who happened to know a lot of people because he traveled around. He had an absolute gift for friendship on many fronts with many people. I think I was somewhere down in, you know, the more recent echelons of it all, and some of the people like Tom Slay, who was part of our circle and is a, you know, central presence here and has been. But just to think of, I made a little list of some of the people who were truly deep, lifelong friends of Seamus's, just to name a few, and there are many I'm not naming, and I'm not including extensive family and so on, but Helen Vendler, Bernard McCabe, Seamus Dean, Michael and Edna Longley, Paul Muldoon, Derek Walcott, Joseph Brodsky, both Czeslaw Milosz and Stanislaw Baranczak, who were both key figures. He had a great affinity for the Poles, as you might be gathering. Ted Hughes, the sculptor Dmitry Hadzi, with whom he was traveling when he heard about his Nobel Prize. He was in Greece. The singer David Hammond, and then just dozens and dozens of poets and artists the world over. And he gave. I'm humbled by, in retrospect, because I realize now that I can't tell him personally. You know, I realize in retrospect how extremely generous he was to me, out of all proportion and measure. And there's not just me, but I know this is true of many of us who knew him. If a book came out and if you sent your book to Seamus, you would get a beautiful, long, pages-long, handwritten letter telling you about your book and what it meant and his experience of reading it. And it's just, you know, I didn't do the same for him. His books came out and I figured the whole world is adoring Seamus and I would, you know, clap him on the back. But now I think, no, we're all, at some level, that's what we want to hear, that we were heard in that way, and I wish I had, you know. And but anyway, but I'm just thinking of these two forces. They would seem to be utterly contradictory, the one drilling in and the other one spreading out and extending. And I truly don't know how he combined the two and did both at such a extraordinary level of so it is, it's sort of, you know, I think of it as a kind of genius, and I think of it as a mystery, and it's a mystery that I realize now I don't particularly want to solve. I don't want to find out that there's some, you know, subtle psychological deft maneuver he had that allowed him. I just think it's testament to something that was, you know, big. So I'm going to stop. I don't know if anyone had any questions or anything, we can do that or not. But
if there are questions,
if there are, I don't, you know, no world expert on him. Yes? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If I can do a double dip there. There were certain poets, and I think of them together, Brodsky and Walcott both. They came as a combination package. It was a very unusual season in the Boston area when Seamus was coming to teach at Harvard, Derek Walcott was teaching at Boston University, and Joseph Brodsky was out at Mount Holyoke. And Joseph Brodsky and Walcott were old and fast friends, and Seamus had a strong connection with Derek and was a great admirer, you know, of the image-making power and lyricism of Derek, no question. And at some point, they started to get together. It became a fairly, you know, frequent event that Joseph would drive in and somebody would throw a party and suddenly you'd have your three laureates sitting there. But what I would want to emphasize about those parties, and, you know, was lucky to be present at a few of them, they were not remotely high-minded. They were silly to the point of inanity. The real focus was on who could get off a better one-liner. They were constantly undercutting each other. They were hilarious. And that was to see these three, each one is a very strange-looking individual to begin with. They really are. And to see them sitting on a couch together, just breaking up in, you know, giggles and hilarity, it was it's just kind of remarkable. But yeah, you knew he was never not, Seamus was never not courtly, and he, you know, adored poetry and respected and, you know, implicitly was on the side of anyone who practiced the art. But you knew, or I felt that just seeing him in different situations and hearing him talk, you know, when the particular nerve had been struck in him, when you were getting his higher sort of sanction and accolade as a poet. And I think that is what is the whole mentoring question. I was wondering about that because I knew that he had a mentoring presence here, and yet I didn't partake in any of that and don't really know it. I was just trying to extrapolate and thinking that from my angle, the truest mentoring in a way that he did was through conveying by these, you know, personal subtle signals that he was accepting you into his circle of fellow poet. And that's, I mean, that's far and above, it's a bigger, more lasting thing than having someone, you know, go through your lines and mark them or count your iams or something. To feel that somebody who is definitely of that, you know, talent and capacity sort of give you the sign that you were welcome in his book. That was kind of a real, that was a sort of gift, I think, that people took away that they really could use. And I don't think he ever faltered from that. He just stayed steady, remarkably. So, any others? Yes?
What was his favorite drink?
He liked straight vodka. He liked Jameson's. He would put up with wine, because that's usually what we served, but he was always waiting for the moment when after dinner, you know, someone would bring out the Jamesons. That made him happy. Yes, sir.
I was hoping that for context, we would hear a few lines of his poetry to put us
well,
in a place.
We could do that. Sure. That's a good place to go. Let me just, if you give me a few seconds.
And I'll have a second.
All right. Well, I'm looking for something that's my own deep favorite. This is kind of a less high-toned Seamus. This is the domestic Seamus. This is a poem written to his wife, Mari. It's called The Otter. When you plunged, the light of Tuscany wavered and swung through the pool from top to bottom. I loved your wet head and smashing crawl, your fine swimmer's back and shoulders surfacing and surfacing again this year and every year since. I sat dry-throated on the warm stones. You were beyond me. The mellowed clarities, the grape-deep air thinned and disappointed. Thank God for the slow loadening. When I hold you now, we are close and deep as the atmosphere on water. My two hands are plumbed water. You are my palpable, lithe otter of memory in the pool of the moment. Turning to swim on your back, each silent thigh-shaking kick, retilting the light, heaving the cool at your neck, and suddenly you're out, back again, intent as ever, heavy and frisky in your freshened pelt, printing the stones. So that's... Okay. Good. And you said you had another question.
A little bit of inspiration.
Yeah, I wonder if you just happen to know the poetry of Michael Cody.
I don't. Michael Cody, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, from Southern Ireland.
Uh-huh, I don't.
I'm sure.
But that he would join a large company of poets, I don't know. But some. Yes. Oh, I thought there was a hand. All right, it looks like we're done with the hands. Wait.
Can I ask before we quit about, you mentioned the Polish connection. It's perhaps appropriate with our support tonight from CBC.
Sure.
Say something about that affinity that he had, I think, for something about the greatness of Polish.
Yeah, I think it was on many fronts. I mean, I would say that his mortal deity was Czesław Miłosz, and that was the only person who I felt, I mean, he moved among so many of his very well-known and awarded equals, but the one person that he seemed to sort of hold at a slightly awestruck distance was Miłosz. I think it's several things. One is there's still an age difference, maybe 10 or 15 years. There was the shared Catholicism of origins. There was the deep sort of testing by fire that Miłosz had been through. I think he needed, a master. And when Miłosz died, I know he went to Krakow, I think, for the funeral. And that was a very big occasion in his life. He was very attached to a poet in Cambridge who we didn't see much because he suffered from various ailments, so he was usually off the radar, but Stanislaw Baranczak. They were close. He was, as we heard tonight, he was a great admirer of Zbigniew Herbert. He certainly admired Wisława Szymborska tremendously. He loved the intensity of their irony, I think. It's not slack contemporary wise guy irony, but it was deep historical irony, irony that spoke out of things gone through that entitled the user to it. I think that really compelled him. That's what I'd say on the matters. Polish.
Thank you.
Yes.
Have you ever been to Ireland?
Yes. In fact, since I mentioned Tom Slay and another friend, Oskold Melnichuk, and my wife Lynn, and Tom Slay's then-wife Ellen Driscoll, and Oskold's wife Alex Johnson, we went to Dublin to pay a visit to Seamus, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, and this is an indication somehow of the kind of person. He set everything aside for 3 days. We got in several cars. We drove to the west of Ireland. He took us to Lady Gregory's, a cool park. We went to
3 miles away, William Butler.
Yes, we went there. Yes,
and
we were.
I had the night light in my home.
Oh, do you really?
My father.
Oh, why?
Peter's Way.
That's fantastic.
And would run the. He was the only person in the village that had a vehicle, and it was a bicycle. It was just needed. Well, there were cars.
Yeah.
And the horses were needed.
Yeah.
So my father would run the messages to Lady Gregory and then wait for her to write, and he would bring them back. Unfortunately, they destroyed her home. At the
yeah.
And
yeah.
At the beach, my father saw Casey and other people put their names.
Yeah, no, we saw the
but
beach.
If you've been there,
yes.
Then you know that all this behavior, the socks on the radio, it's all normal.
Yeah, but when I first encountered it, it was unfamiliar.
You know, let's have a drink. That's
yes.
That's the way it is.
It is, and should be.
Yes,
absolutely.
But he said he's a regular Irishman.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just would mention, since I read the poem sort of to his wife, Mari, but he got so much limelight, but they were such a team. And she was just right there and steering him and telling him when he was being to this or to. I mean, they had a really dynamically contentious and loving relationship. But she was such a part of the picture, and she went on that same trip with us. I don't want to make it seem just Seamus and us. It was Mari, and it was sort of, en famille, as he liked to say.
But they wouldn't.
They wouldn't what? Say that? No.
It's French.
No, I know. But he still. I've heard him. I've heard him say it. I've heard him say en famille. I have. I really have.
Fire with the French against the English.
Who wouldn't?
There you go. I think great moment. Thank you all. Thank you.